Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of February 3rd, 2012. Go Patriots. The Facebook IPO. Yes, we've heard plenty about what it means for investors, but how might the public offering affect the rest of us?
So every single quarter, every year, they're going to have to make more and more and more money, which means they're just going to have to get more and more money out of you.
We'll look at the ins and outs of a social network on Wall Street. Helping out elders in your family can be a trying task. There are warning signs that loved ones might not be able to handle their own finances.
You go out to a restaurant with your dad, and he's having trouble figuring the tip, and he's putting down way too much money.
And in a world where women are constantly told to reach for all the stars,
if you try and excel at everything, all that will happen is you will just be average at everything.
We chat with Mrs. Moneypenny about what it means to have it all. Coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
A three-year low. Now that is something to celebrate, isn't it? It is when you're talking about unemployment in this country. Pretty much any economist will tell you that there cannot be an economic recovery without recovery in the job market. If you don't have a job, you're not going to spend money. So, yes, the addition of nearly a quarter of a million jobs to company payrolls last month is party worthy. But just how big of a party? Well, to help us answer that question, we turn to economist Chris Lowe of FTN Financial. He's a regular guest on the Marketplace Morning Report every Friday, and we are borrowing him today. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So there was quite a bit of hooping and hollering about this number when it came out, but one wonders if perhaps it should maybe have only been hooping.
Well, look, you know, we haven't had a really good jobs number in a while. There was a stretch of 3 months from February to April last year, and then after that, of course, we had that terrible soft patch where everyone was worried about recession.
Right.
And it's been a slow crawl out since that. So all of a sudden, 200,000 plus numbers in a row. Economists were expecting a pullback, and instead we had an acceleration. And maybe a little bit of euphoria is okay.
Okay, well, we'll take that. For the folks who are still out there pounding the pavement looking for work, what do they take out of this report in terms of perhaps industries that are hiring more than others? Where is the real silver lining here?
Well, and that's what I liked about the report more than just about anything, is that it was a really broad-based gain in the private sector this month. We saw 50,000 new manufacturing jobs, which is the strongest in a long time, 21,000 new construction jobs. There was hiring in healthcare, which has been, you know, that's been strong for years, but that continues to be a leader. Not all that many temps, but there were some there as well. We actually like to see permanent hires rather than temporary hires, so that's okay. Business services was strong as well. And then retail was decent. And that's a really good sign when you see that in the first quarter, because particularly this year, there was more retail hiring in the fourth quarter for Christmas than there has been in the last couple of years. That was one of the areas where we expected a pullback.
You mentioned construction, and is it possible to say, because that is getting a boost in jobs, that says something also about where we are with housing?
Well, maybe a tiny bit. Housing is still in really big trouble, at least from a builder's standpoint, because prices are falling. And in most of the U.S., you can buy a house for less than it costs to build, which means nobody's going to build one. Where we are seeing strength in construction, we're beginning to see a recovery on the commercial side. There hasn't been an office building or a hotel started in the U.S. In about 3 years. And we're starting to see vacancy rates fall. And because it takes a few years from start to finish on those projects, that's a place where hiring is picking up, and it's only going to get better.
All right. Well, so to sum up this report from January, is it possible to kind of tell people how they're supposed to feel at this point? Because, as you know, kind of how we're feeling, it's all psychological, how we're feeling and that kind of determines whether we're going to go out and spend money. Can you give us an idea of what we're supposed to think at this point?
Well, absolutely. Look, you know, perspective, right? There are still millions of people who have been out of work for more than 6 months. And hiring of a couple of hundred thousand, while it looks good by recent standards, is not going to pull them back into the workforce right away.
Yeah.
So from that sense, there's still that worry. But we had almost 3% growth in the fourth quarter. We have hiring that's consistent with that going forward. If it continues, then I think the right way to look at this is if it can be sustained, we will be in a better mood next month and again the month after that. And that's certainly a big improvement over the sort of growing pessimism we felt from last spring right through the winter.
All right. Chris Lowe, Chief Economist with FTN Financial in New York. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Despite the good news from Friday's report, the fact is millions of people are still out of work, as Chris said, and college grads are having trouble launching their careers. Sure, the economy is mostly to blame, but commentator Ramit Sethi says they should be looking in the mirror, too.
I recently read a heartbreaking quote in the New York Times. It was from a 23-year-old Dartmouth graduate who was forced to wait tables for a few dollars an hour to pay off her student loans. "We did everything we were supposed to," she said. "What was the point of working so hard for 22 years if there was nothing out there?" I feel for her. Times are tough. But I also want to offer some blunt thoughts about the job market. It's become popular to claim that there are no jobs, but that's simply not true. I know firsthand. I regularly teach my students how to write persuasive resumes and conquer their job interviews. Within weeks, many of them have multiple job offers. So why do we spend so much time complaining about the economy instead of actually finding our dream job? To find out, I polled over 20,000 people, mostly in their 20s and 30s. The code word for our generation's career outlook is betrayed. It's not that we're lazy or feel entitled. We worked hard and we did everything we were told, yet here we are with crippling student debt and few opportunities. Many of us claim we want to find our dream job, but most of us have done very little to actually get it. Instead, we're doing more of the same, mindlessly sending out resume after resume. Honestly, if you send out 200 resumes with no response, will sending 100 more really change anything? Here's one simple step to take power back into your hands. Invite 3 people per week out for informational interviews. Use your network, college alums, friends, friends of friends, people who already have your dream job. Ask them how they got their jobs, and then turn the table. Tell them how you've prepared for your dream job. Impress them with your strengths and skills. Even in this economy, hiring managers are looking for top talent. At the end of the month, you'll have built 12 relationships that can connect you to job openings, while others will still just be complaining about the economy.
Ramit Sethi is the author of I Will Teach You to Be Rich. Next week, we'll expand on this commentary in an interview with Ramit about the best strategies for job hunting. We're staying on the subject of jobs now, but we're switching our focus to Egypt. The Egyptian government says the unemployment rate there is around 12%, but many Egyptians say the real figure is much higher. On the first anniversary of the revolution that drove President Hosni Mubarak from power, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is reporting a special series on post-revolutionary Egypt. It's called One Year On. Today he looks at the plight of young Egyptians, 18 to 24 years old, facing an estimated unemployment rate of 80%.
Tahrir Square is the epicenter of the revolution, but it's also a kind of giant open-air unemployment office. Thousands of the young people that gather here are out of work, and 1 year after the overthrow of President Mubarak, they're still protesting about the lack of jobs. 24-year-old Mohammed El Hakim finished his degree in mechanical engineering 18 months ago. He still can't find a job. He says the army-controlled government hasn't done anything to help. The revolution has changed nothing.
طبعا هو احساس صعب جدا كان انا ما اتعلمتش اساسا يعني كان ما فيش قيمه للي انا اتعلمته.
And he feels as if his degree is worthless and his education a waste of time. Being unemployed here isn't easy. You get no financial help at all from the government. A street vendor weaves his way through the square. There are dozens of these hawkers here, selling cheap food and drink to the protesters. That does at least make Tahrir an inexpensive place for the unemployed to spend the day. Cairo resident Iyad Dawood.
When you are in Tahrir, you eat Tahrir food. You drink the Tahrir drinks, which is a cup of tea for £1, or a kibda sandwiches for £2. All these in Tahrir Square, and they're all cheap.
That's a cup of tea and a sandwich for less than 50 US cents. Dawood himself lost his job and was out of work for a year, and he says he suffered the humiliation of having to go home and sponge off his parents.
Doesn't feel any good when you start taking allowance from your mother again and can I have £20 today so that I can just go do something? why do you need this £20 for? And you start having all these flashbacks of scenes that used to happen 10 and 12 years ago and you thought it was over.
Dawood is one of the lucky ones. His well-heeled parents were able to support him while he was looking for a job and protesting. Economist Ahmed Ghonim says most of the unemployed have to eke out a living doing odd, menial jobs in the black economy.
The black market economy, the underground economy, is acted as the social safety net for those people to survive.
Parking and washing cars or street vending, hundreds of thousands of young, unemployed and often educated people are struggling to make ends meet. Hadia Hassan says her cousin has a business degree and he's driving a rickshaw.
The educated and the uneducated both drive rickshaws because there are no opportunities for work. And there are educated people who work in coffee shops.
Hadia herself has not found a job since she graduated from high school last summer. She's worried that she's becoming a burden on her father, a cab driver. His meagre income is the family's sole means of support. Hadia cannot turn to the government for help.
The government doesn't give me welfare. The government doesn't give anyone welfare. All the people in this country have to fend for themselves.
Hadia is not one of the protesters in Tahrir Square. She seems to take a rather jaundiced view of the revolution. She doesn't believe it will bring her a job. In Cairo, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. It's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is our own Chris Farrell, economics editor for Marketplace. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Tess. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you. And you?
You know, things are good right now.
Well, one of the things that we're going to see here in 2012, it looks like, is that the Department of Labor is set to issue some new rules about 401k investment plans. And this has been in the works for a while, hasn't it?
Isn't it about time? Don't you think that you should know if you're putting that money into 401k month after month, that you should know what the cost of that is, what
right.
fees are being charged?
So what these new rules are going to do, presumably, or at least what they're intended to do, is to give a little more transparency to things like fees. But my question for you is, how much good is this really going to do? Because I have serious questions about whether people even look at any of this stuff. Is anybody really doing the homework that they're supposed to be doing?
Oh, but some people will. We all know colleagues that look at these numbers very closely and they talk to other people. And basically, I think this is a case where sunshine is truly a disinfectant. That as this information gets out there, there's already discussion that a number of employers have decided to add low-cost index funds to their options because they're realizing, hey, you know, employees might be unhappy with the fees that are being charged. So I think overall, no, it's not going to be a dramatic revolution. It's not even going to be a revolution, but it's going to push the system in the right direction.
All right. Well, let's head to the phones. And Portia in New York City. Hi there.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan.
Now, what do you do there in the big city?
I'm an economic researcher. I work in international development.
So are you an economics major?
I have a degree in international development with a focus on development economics.
Well, so we're going to take this down to microeconomics for you. And
yes, we are.
How can we help you out?
So I would like to talk to you about a different retirement system. The in-laws who live in Mexico are nearing retirement age, and we're looking to help them with their financial planning. And I thought that you might be just the people to advise us on how to proceed.
First of all, I have a bit of a red flag going up that they're just starting to do financial planning and they're about to retire?
I'm not sure that they're about to retire. They're nearing retirement age, but I don't think they have any plans to slow down in the near future.
Okay, good.
How are their finances?
They don't have any savings.
Okay.
And how old are they?
Nearing 60.
No savings at all.
Well, as is typical for a lot of people in many places in the world, there's very little separation between the finances of their business and their personal finances.
Okay. And what kind of system is there from the government in Mexico?
You know, that I'm not really sure about that.
I guess as a baseline, we will just not deal with whatever they're getting from the Mexican government, since we're not familiar with that system. But Chris, what's the first step here?
I think the first conversation is between you and your partner.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like the most important conversation, because this is going to be going on for a long period of time, hopefully. I mean, and I want everyone to have a long life. And there are going to be issues that come up. If there's no savings, how much support can you give? And so in all these conversations, you know, we always talk about, well, how do you approach the parents? But I think the most important conversation is you and your partner being on the same page. Because at their age, you're not going to be doing any personality transplants.
We are very fortunate in that we are a couple who share very similar views on personal finance. This is a conversation that he is going to have with his parents once we discover what's the best way for us to help them. Unfortunately, at this stage, we are not able to offer any financial assistance. So the only capital we can offer is our human capital in the advice department.
Whenever dealing with parents-in-law, it's a conversation. It's not something you're going to solve over a vacation or you're going to have a big talk, you know, the summit meeting. And it's something that you want to raise under different circumstances, not have a lot of pressure. It's really no different than in a relationship with a spouse or a partner. You kind of want to kind of have an ongoing conversation about money, dealing with it little by little, as opposed to trying to deal with everything at once. Another is, I do have a book to recommend, which I do like a lot.
Oh, how wonderful.
It's in English and in Spanish.
Perfect.
The English title is The Latino Journey to Financial Greatness, and it's by Luis Barajas. And then there's a Spanish version, which starts out with El Camino. I think all of you should read this book.
Okay.
Because it's very built within the Latino community about and family relations and a lot of the sort of values. You know, what are you trying to accomplish in this life? What is wealth to you, both materially and spiritually? I mean, it's not so much of a specifically a retirement book as opposed to it's, you know, it's a money book over a lifetime. And how do you approach money?
That sounds really wonderful. That sounds like something that they would enjoy thinking about. And it also sounds like it's culturally tailored as well, which is important.
Portia, is there any concern on your part that you could end up footing the bill in some way here for their retirement?
That's what we'd like to avoid, because we're not currently in a position to be able to offer a whole lot of help.
You know, I know it's not easy to say, but I'd say, look, we love you. We really do. We really love you.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to have conversations and we want to deal with this. But we're not going to be able to help you out financially. And so that's the baseline of this whole discussion that we're going to be having over the next couple of years, because you are getting older and you're going to have health needs and you're probably not going to want to work as much. So obviously you can do research, you can go on the computer, you can do spreadsheets for them, you have a conversation about the book, but what you have to make very clear is...
That's what I'm good at.
That's what you're good at, not money.
Well, get that conversation going.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for the call. Bye-bye.
Have a great day. Bye.
All right, now we go to Jeffrey, and he is in, he's just down the 710 in Long Beach. Hi, how are you, Jeffrey?
Hi, I'm doing great.
Good. You're not terribly far away from us here in the Los Angeles studios.
No, we've been living in Long Beach since about 2006 when I bought a house, and the market was pretty...
Wait a minute. You bought a house in 2006?
Yes, that was really... It was that or try to find a rental. And
why did you buy a house instead of a rental?
So we were looking in Long Beach. My grandmother was in Long Beach, and we wanted to be close to her. And when we looked at rentals, the cost for rentals versus the cost of the mortgage we could get was higher. So even though the market was overvalued, we just felt that we would be paying so much more on a rental. And if I had known the bubble would have collapsed a little faster, I certainly wouldn't have done what I did.
This was not unusual, Chris, back in the mid part of the decade.
Look, there's a lot of regret there. Now, how large a family are we talking about?
So I have four kids, and, you know, we were looking at rentals. The yards were just so small that it was nice to have a sort of big piece of land for us to play and do things.
Yeah.
Although I think our biggest mistake was buying a fixer-upper.
How has that fixer-upping been going?
Well, you know, we did put some things in it to upgrade the electrical. It had knob and tubes. And the biggest problem, though, is we delayed doing the roof. And then when the price of the house fell, now we're stuck with a leaky roof and no real easy way to sort of look at, well, should we fix it or not?
How bad a price drop are we looking at with you?
I've done some guesses, and I'm going to guess that we probably, the price of the house dropped $200,000.
Okay, so are you underwater with your mortgage?
Yeah, probably by about $100,000.
How is the situation for you? Is it something that you can just live with?
Well, things would have been great if I hadn't lost my job about a year ago.
Oh, dear.
So,
I'm sorry to hear that.
2 years ago, I lost my job, and I was out of work for 11 months. And so that blew through our savings, the savings that we were going to use to repair the roof. And so when the roof started leaking this winter, and I did find a job, but it's out of the area, and so I have been living away from the family during the week, it's just a lot of funny complications that we're still working through.
What kind of conversations are you having around the dinner table then? That must not be easy for you and your wife.
It isn't. So I do video game development. That field is a lot more prevalent in the San Francisco Bay Area where I have my job now. So I've been trying to encourage us to move. It's just difficult to uproot a family.
What do you feel like your options are right now?
I had hoped to work with the mortgage lender that we could somehow work out a deal that if we stayed in the home that, you know, I could get some additional money to do at least the roof repair. Because we have looked at just sort of walking away and going to a rental.
Yeah. What does your wife want to do?
She wants to stay.
Then are you willing to stay in a house that is underwater?
Actually, I am.
So then what's your question?
What are my options? How do I help work with a lender to, hey, can we drop the mortgage a little bit temporarily so I can get this roof repaired so it's not leaking on my son's bed?
So by and large, you figure your mortgage lender's not going to be helpful. I'm sure you've talked to them, you've approached them, and their response has probably been just silence. So what do we do now? And in listening to you talk, I just get a sense of let's go back to the basics, the real fundamental basics. When you're talking about options, and it's less about finances and more about lifestyle, and it's about your relationships. And the fact is, if it's the right thing for you to do as a family to move to San Francisco, the kids will adjust. Because whatever you do, you don't want to get back into a situation where you made a move and then the trapdoor opens up on you. Because you don't want any more damage to the house with the leaky roof. I put a priority on that and then really focus on what Tess was talking about, the kitchen table conversations.
It's a tough spot to be in. And, you know, you're asking yourself the same questions that millions of homeowners are asking themselves. And every time we deal with the walking away question on this program, you know, we get angry mail from listeners who say, how could you ever encourage anyone to do that? It's your moral responsibility, et cetera, et cetera. But I truly believe that it's your individual decision and it has to be what is good for your family. But it sounds to me like your wife does not want to leave.
I think that is very clear.
If you have made this commitment, you have decided that you're going to do whatever it takes to stay. And one of the prices that you will probably pay for this lifestyle is that when you do sell the home, you're going to take a loss.
You're right. I think that it is. That is the topic of dinner conversation around the Kessler family household.
And unfortunately, that's not a decision that we can really make for you.
It's just helpful to talk this out. It really is a lot of soul searching for us, and we're doing that this week.
Yeah. Well, good luck, Jeffrey.
Thank you very much.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can send us an email with the Getting Personal link on our website. That's at marketplace.org/money. Chris, thanks so much. It's been great.
Oh, it's been fun. Thanks, Tess.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. The decision to take away the car keys from an elderly parent is a tough one, and the same thing goes for taking away the checkbook. Neurologists say elderly people's financial decisions can provide early warning signs for Alzheimer's or dementia, and it can be a clue as to when children should step in. Our Economy 4.0 series is about how to make the economy better serve more people. David Brancaccio reports from northern Minnesota.
It's a colossal road trip just to see Dad. Rick and Lori Barber have driven the same 200 miles from Minneapolis to Grand Rapids, Minnesota, 23 times in the past year. The 15-foot roadside walleye means they're still not there.
You can't see it. There's a huge fish on the other side. That's like the halfway mark between Grand Rapids and Minneapolis.
We're halfway.
It's a four-hour trek each way, every 2 weeks to visit Rick's father. Sadly, Dick Barber, who's 78, has dementia and lives in assisted living near his old house.
Okay, Dick, you can let go. Yeah.
Rick says his father had hundreds of thousands of dollars set aside for his retirement in savings and stocks. But then Dick's wife passed away, cancer. Dick's own health deteriorated. And then he started to make some strange financial decisions.
It's funny, when the wine started coming, we thought it was a gift from one of my sisters or something. And everybody said, we didn't give it to him. And then eventually he got a bill. Yeah, it was hundreds of dollars a month.
You see, Dick had always been a very careful man with a dollar. Family vacations tended to be frugal camping trips. But seemingly out of nowhere, he was buying stuff like expensive subscriptions and giving to charities, lots of them. And he was paying for graduate school, weddings, down payments on houses.
You know, as a neuropsychologist, what I would be thinking is this someone who has now got significant short-term memory loss?
Dr. Daniel Marson is a professor of neurology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Marson's found that there's a relationship between neurocognitive disorders and financial decisions. He says a first sign of Alzheimer's or dementia may not be mom or dad forgetting names, but a change in how they handle their money.
Mom's check log, which used to be very just sort of a model of clarity, maybe there's nothing there or just an occasional entry, or you go out to a restaurant with your dad and he's having trouble figuring the tip and he's putting down way too much money.
Other warning signs? Bills going unpaid, parents not filing taxes. Marson's designed a clinical test to help doctors notice these kinds of changes in their patients. But even if the warning signs are there, children tend to look the other way.
But the fact is that the individual undergoing decline often lacks insight into the fact that they are undergoing this decline, and so they're not going to be calling out for help. And particularly if they might have lost a spouse, they're going to be very vulnerable.
Lori says after her mother-in-law died, Dick's financial confusion got worse. They looked at his bank account and discovered hundreds of dollars in overdraft fees. With the permission of other siblings, Rick and Lori took over Dick's accounts.
He just very quietly just handed us the checkbook. It was pretty sad. We'd already taken his ability to drive away, and so it was just another step in losing.
Okay, you're okay.
Rick and Lori take Dick to the site of a house they're building for him. It'll be a modest place, but will include a small apartment for a live-in nurse.
Your fireplace will be right here.
So I put the couch right here.
Dick's now in a wheelchair and doesn't speak much, but when they take him around, he grins.
You like that?
The couple promised Rick's father he could live out his life by the lake he loves.
Dick, I'm going to go down backwards because I think it'll be better for you.
His wife's ashes are buried under a tree by the shore.
I'll leave you alone for a second, okay?
Dr. Mark Lacks is director of geriatrics at New York Presbyterian and the author of the book Treat Me, Not My Age. He says that the Barbers are far from alone in their situation. By age 85, about 45% of us will have some form of cognitive impairment.
So while we want to protect older people to have freedom of decision-making around how they use their finances, I think we have to acknowledge legislatively the impact of an aging population and somehow create a system that protects people from decision-making that's based on brain disease.
Later that day, the Barbers drop Dad back at his temporary setup at the assisted living place.
So, Dad, it'll probably be a couple weeks I'll be back here.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. See you.
Well, welcome home, Dick. You have a good time.
they complete the dark drive back to Minneapolis. It'll be a 13-hour road trip. Rick says, of course, he's happy to help his father. He only wishes that he'd stepped in earlier.
It's hard to know, you know, if you want to respect independence, but at the same time, as soon as that, if you know that their money's not going to last, as soon as it's gone, you're the one that's going to be paying for it. So in retrospect now, it seems to me you have more of a right to be more forcefully involved earlier in the process, as maybe that's something to talk to them about.
He adds it would have saved his father and he and his wife a lot of money, six-figure amounts of money, that the younger Barbers could have used for their own retirement savings. I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace Money.
And our Economy 4.0 coverage continues next week with a story about how older people often fall victim to financial abuse at the hands of their own family members. David talks with a prosecutor about the telltale signs Monday on Marketplace. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Today, there is no shortage of women sitting at the head of the table. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson, Harvard President Drew Gilpin Faust, just to name a few. They have shattered the glass ceiling while juggling careers and family. But Heather McGregor, a.k.a. Mrs. Moneypenny, says women who believe they can have it all are just setting themselves up to be average. Mrs. Moneypenny is a former investment banker, a wife, and a mother of three, and she's currently a columnist for the Financial Times. Her new book is Sharpen Your Heels, Mrs. Moneypenny's Career Advice for Women. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's very nice to be here.
I'd like to start by having you read a passage from Chapter 5 of your book, if you would. And this is the chapter entitled, You Can't Have It All.
Absolutely. Young women today are raised to believe that the sky is the limit. I adore ambition, and I believe that women should be encouraged to be ambitious from an early age. But to grow up thinking, and being encouraged to think, that it is perfectly possible to be the CEO of a large public company, or a brilliant brain surgeon, or a concert violinist, or whatever, and achieve this while securing and maintaining a gorgeous husband, having an amazing sex life, conceiving and raising perfectly balanced children, keeping up your league hockey at the weekends, plus still have time to see your girlfriends and your parents, get to the hairdresser and have your nails done, and finally to your Pilates classes, is to be severely deluded.
Oh, Mrs. Moneypenny, I'm afraid you're committing heresy here.
No, well, I don't think so. I mean, do you manage all of that?
I manage all of it except the children, which I do not have.
Right. Well, there you go. Yeah, already you've got one thing less to have to try and juggle.
Right.
But
right.
I don't think that women can have it all, because I think that if you try and excel at everything, all that will happen is you will just be average at everything. And I think women have very hard choices in life. And many women, by the way, don't have children and still face difficult choices because they have aged parents or a disabled relative or something else in their life. There are lots of challenges in our careers.
Well, staying with the topic of careers, I want to talk about networking. And, you know, this is an issue that you address at great length in the book. Can you give us a couple of your top suggestions for how women can develop and expand their networks?
Yes, I mean, everybody brings two things to a position. They bring their human capital, which is whatever college degrees you have or professional qualifications. But secondly, you bring your social capital, which are the people that you know. And I define somebody I know as somebody who will return my telephone call or my email. And by the way, one has not replaced the other. I've got no time for this people who say, oh, well, you know, who you know has replaced what you know. Actually, it hasn't. Students of logic know that it's both necessary but not sufficient to have good qualifications. And the same thing is true of a good network. If you are an absolutely, for instance, rubbish lawyer and you have a brilliant network, all that happens is a lot of people know that you're a rubbish lawyer. Okay? So you do need to have both. And for women, I think when you're at the beginning of your career, you should look around you and really work on getting to know your peer group. Because, you know, if you graduated from college and you're ambitious and you're at the start of your career, you will spot other people like you, both in your company and in your clients or in your customers. you know, spot those people and try and meet them regularly and build relationships with them, because they will be the leaders of the future.
But of course, if you're doing all this meeting and greeting and networking, that's going to take some time, which gets us back to...
You can't have it all.
You can't have it all. Exactly. Mm. So you have a wonderful story in the book where you talk about how difficult it is to say no to anything.
Yes, and it is very difficult. Saying no is a key life skill. And I think, again, we are conditioned to please as women. I mean, without wanting to make too light of this subject, I think it's a bit like getting your legs waxed. You know, it feels very uncomfortable for a short period of time, but the long-term gain is really worth it.
Okay, I think most of the women in our audience can probably relate to that. What decisions have you made in realizing that you couldn't have it all?
Well, for a very good start, I have a body mass index of 37, which you can't see on the radio, but I promise you. And it's because I just don't get to the gym often enough.
Uh-huh.
You know, if I have spare time, it goes to my children or my husband or, you know, everything else. I am at the bottom of my priority list. So that is a difficult choice I have made. I would love to be able to wear size 4 clothes. You know, that would be great. But it's not something I've been able to find the time to get around to doing.
I do have to ask Mrs. Moneypenny, are you related at all to Miss Moneypenny? And if so, how is Mr. Bond?
Sadly, I am Mrs. Moneypenny, and I'm totally unrelated. I was given my name. Although I am actually 50 in March, I was born officially in 1999, and I was given birth to by the Financial Times. And they gave me that name, and 12 and a half years later, I still have it.
Mrs. Moneypenny is the author of Sharpen Your Heels, Mrs. Moneypenny's Career Advice for Women. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been fun.
You're extremely welcome. Thank you.
Of course, plenty of women still believe they can have it all. And some of them started their own businesses to make that happen. But for all the entrepreneurial spirit that exists in this country, it is not evenly divided along gender lines. Most entrepreneurs are men, and women-owned businesses are far less likely to hit the million-dollar revenue mark. Ashley Milne-Tite met two women who've taken very different paths to having it all.
Lori Ames had just got off an airplane on her first day of vacation in Vegas. Then her cell phone rang. That call changed her life. Her ex-husband told her their 21-year-old son, Robert, had been rushed to the hospital with a brain tumor. She had to come home to Long Island.
And the first couple of days, he really didn't speak or react to anything. And they would come in and they would pinch him and say they would do things like say, Robert, what's your name? Robert, you have to answer us.
Lori was vice president at a small PR firm in Manhattan. She'd worked there for 20 years. Now she was at her son's bedside day and night. Her boss kept asking when Lori would be back. But then Robert had his third surgery.
They told me that he was going to need chemotherapy and he was going to need radiation and he was going to need all these treatments. I realized there was just no way that my life was ever going to be the same, and I didn't see how I would possibly be able to go back to commuting to Manhattan every day more than an hour each way.
Lori had always relied on the security of a steady paycheck, but she quit her job and started her own publicity business at home because it let her fit work around her son. The doctors gave Robert a good prognosis, but recovery was going to take a long time.
When he came home, I sent out an email over LinkedIn to everybody saying, hey, just in case you're looking for me, here's what's going on. I'm going to be working from home. If you want to reach me, here's how you can do it.
She got her first client right away. Now, a year later, her company, the PR Freelancer, is bringing in $100,000 in revenue. Lori has one part-time employee and an office near the house with an unconventional setup.
This is technically Robert's half of the office, with his recliner and his flat screen and his refrigerator. We have extra folding chairs for meetings.
Robert spends every day at the office with his mum. The trauma to his brain means he gets stressed if he's left alone, and he sometimes has trouble processing his thoughts. But when Robert's here, he feels safe.
Yeah, I enjoy just fine. It's just like being at home. I'm comfortable. I'm just happy that mom's happy.
Lori's thrilled, but she never expected to start a business and hasn't given much thought to growth yet. That's something another Long Island business owner wishes more women would do. Maureen Borzicello is CEO of Creative Display Solutions, an event management company. She says a lot of women entrepreneurs don't focus on growing their businesses because their families take priority. She says women also tend to lack confidence.
Can I really do this?
is it okay for me to want to grow a multi-million-dollar business? I found that as I was becoming more successful, I caught myself apologizing, and I didn't know why I was really doing it. Why should I apologize for my success? I bust my butt to be successful.
Maureen started the business in 2001 because she decided to change her life drastically. She wanted to be her own boss and have a baby. She'd been working 60 to 80-hour weeks at her previous company. She knew she couldn't put in those hours and cope with a newborn. So she founded her company and had a baby son. After a year or so, and he was a toddler, she began putting a lot more time and energy into the business. Her warehouse is stacked with signs from recent trade shows.
And then we'll stage clients' assets. We'll put them up, we'll inspect them. If they get damaged out at a show, we'll repair them, etc.
Maureen's become comfortable with her success. But until quite recently, the U.S. government wasn't sure women even deserved to be in charge. Julie Weeks runs WomenAble, which assesses female-owned businesses. She says it was only 24 years ago, beginning in 1988.
That women could hold business credit in their own name. Prior to that time, they had to get a male co-signing a business loan, even if it was their husband, their son, some, you know, unrelated guy who didn't have anything to do with the business.
Maureen Borzicello had no trouble getting credit when she started, but she still runs up against some irritating assumptions. Take the time a state inspector dropped in.
And I introduced myself. The person heard the last name and asked if my husband was here. And I said, well, why would you need to speak to my husband? And he said, well, isn't he the owner of the company? And I said, no, I'm the owner of the company. I own it 100%. It was very comical because at that point, my husband had come on board. I had hired him as an employee.
For the last several years, Maureen has focused on increasing sales and hiring new staff. Her company now brings in $4 million a year. Sure, she says, growing the business means she still works 70 hours a week when things are really busy, around 3 months of the year. But now Maureen has a staff she can also leave early to pick up her now 9-year-old son from school. She's proud of her achievements.
Because you know what? I'm creating jobs. I am actually an engine of change in this economy. We've increased our staff this year by 20%. So yes, we're a small business, but 20% still meant that we hired 2 or 3 new people.
Something she hopes to keep doing in the years to come. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
You've heard the news all week. Facebook is selling shares to the public. Now, we normally don't cover corporate news in this space, but given that 845 million people around the globe are on Facebook and spend gobs of time on it, and remember, time is money, we thought we'd explore the questions consumers are asking about Facebook this week. And Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has been reporting on it since the news broke. Hi, Stacey.
Hi, Tess.
So we have been hearing about this all week long from the business side of things. But tell me, my friend in real life and Facebook, how is this company going public going to affect little old me?
Basically, they are going to be under enormous earnings pressure now. So every single quarter, every year, they're going to have to make more and more and more money, which means they're just going to have to get more and more money out of you. So that's how it's going to affect you.
All right. Well, how is that going to happen?
Right, because Facebook's free.
Exactly.
But you, Tess, are their product.
I am no
product.
They
sell information about you. So, you know, they're making $3.5 billion a year selling information about you. And they're just going to have to make more, which means they're going to need more and better information on you.
So that means presumably more ads on the side of the page?
It'll mean more ads on the side of the page, but also more relevant ads on the side of the page. One of the big problems with Facebook ads now is that people aren't really clicking on them. That's something that Facebook needs to solve. So, for instance, I Facebook stalked you, Tess. So what I could tell from your Facebook page was you have a couple of beautiful dogs.
I do.
You went to Northwestern. You like McSweeney's. These are all things I could gather from your Facebook page and things I could throw an ad up on your Facebook page, presumably to sell you something.
Right.
But Facebook is going to have to go deeper. They're going to have to synthesize that information more. And part of what will help them do that is timeline. I see you have jumped on the timeline train.
I did. I decided to do it before they forced my hand.
Well, you know, it puts all of your information on a timeline. So, for instance, I was looking at your likes and they're all organized via year. Which is kind of creepy, but interesting. So now marketers can actually track you. So, for instance, they can figure out when your wedding anniversary is and sell you something for your wedding anniversary. So they're going to reach into the soul of Tess Vigeland and try and figure out what makes you tick and what you want and sell you ads based on that stuff.
So it seems to me, and this is always the argument that comes up around privacy, is that, look, we are getting this, I don't know, service, whatever you call it, that is Facebook, for free. And isn't it up to us to make sure that we're not sharing things that we don't want to share?
Well, yes, definitely part of it's up to us. And part of it's also up to Facebook. I mean, they have a lot of information on us that maybe we're not even necessarily aware that they have. So I spoke with James Fowler. He's a social media expert at the University of San Diego. And he says Facebook needs to be really careful with the information that it has on us. Because if we start to feel creeped out, that's a big problem for them. First of all, we'll be less likely to share our information with mm-hmm. them, and we'll also be less likely to use Facebook.
The data that they have access to is probably the best data in the world for targeting, for finding that one person in the world who is most likely to buy your product. But the more they do that in a way that's inconsistent with what people want the Facebook experience to be like, the less people are going to use Facebook.
So he says Facebook needs to watch the creepy factor a lot. And as long as they do that, we will be relaxed into giving up ever more information to Facebook.
Wow. Marketplace's Stacey Manning-Smith. Thanks.
Thanks, Tess.
And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Milwaukee and the home of Carolyn Joy Strongheart. What a name. Carolyn Joy sent us a letter, an actual typewritten letter, outlining her version of the Emergency or Forget You Fund. So we asked her to tell us about it.
You could call it the What Happens Next Fund. Now, in my life, if my husband goes on strike this spring, and it's his income that pays the mortgage, and my income can't pay all the other bills and the mortgage, then the mortgage doesn't get paid, and what happens next? Well, the worst-case scenario is foreclosure. What happens after that? I don't have a place to live. That is not anything I want anywhere close to I want. No way. So, what happens next? In order to prevent the worst-case scenario, you gotta have something to fill the gap. It was a way for me to step by step see what could happen.
And then prepare for it.
Exactly.
Well, I love this idea, and I think it could be very helpful for some of our listeners. And so I want to give you a piggy. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
You're welcome. And I hope if it helps one person, then it shall have been enough. Oink, oink.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, Valentine's Day inflation and how to get around it.
Valentine's Day is on a Tuesday this year. Celebrate it the following weekend. Everything is cheap and, you know, you can go out on the weekend, which is when you probably want to go out anyway.
Or, you know, you could skip it. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Sasha Woodruff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland, packing for Fashion Week in New York City. Hope you can join us for that next week. This is APM, American Public Media.